Baker says, and $100 resort credit. Hear that, gorgeous? Phil says to Sunny. She loves free stuff. We got a discount on our room at Keneal because she told them she's a travel blogger.
We should ask Baker some questions, Sunny says. We know nothing about you. Freddie told us the two of you are just casual acquaintances.
Mom, Ayers says. Freddie? Baker says. That's my daughter's nickname, Phil says, short for Ready Freddie, which was something she used to say often as a child. I can't believe you don't even know her nickname.
Nobody knows my nickname, Ayers says. Nobody.
Baker is still holding the chips and the smoothie, which is turning his hand numb. He's afraid to make himself any more comfortable until he's invited to do so. Well, I grew up in Iowa City, went to Northwestern, graduated with a business degree, worked on the commodities exchange in Chicago for a few years, and then my soon-to-be ex-wife, Anna Schaefer, got a job offer in Houston. She's a cardiothoracic surgeon.
A cardiothoracic surgeon? Sunny says. That's impressive.
Yes, yes, story of Baker's life. The most impressive thing about him is his wife's career. We're in the process of getting a divorce, Baker says. She fell in love with a coworker of hers, a doctor named Louisa Rodriguez. Baker glances at Ayers' parents. They seem unfazed by this. And I have custody of our son, Floyd, who's 4. We'd like to meet Floyd, Phil says.
Another time, Ayers says.
She checks her phone, which is sitting in front of her on the coffee table, and what can Baker think but that he's overstaying his welcome? My brother Cash and my mother Irene are also living with me right now, Baker says. He takes a breath. He has to put down the smoothie. Here. He sets it down in front of Ayers. I brought you this. It's pineapple mango, your favorite.
My favorite after pineapple banana, she says.
Baker deflates and hands over the chips without adding that he made a special trip to Sam and Jack's for them. You don't know her nickname or her favorite smoothie? Phil says. I can see we still have some work to do.
Please stop, Dad, Ayers says. It was very thoughtful of you to bring these, Sunny says, opening the chips and helping herself to one. How interesting that you live with your family of origin.
Yes, well, Baker says. He glances at Ayers. Has she not explained any of his situation to her parents? My father died in a helicopter crash on the first of the year.
So did Rosie, Phil says.
We adored Rosie, Sunny says.
Was the fella she was with your father? Phil asks.
Yes, Baker says. Ayers is staring at her own crossed legs. Why didn't she give her parents the thorny background? And so my mother and brother and I all flew down here to figure out what was going on.
What was going on? Phil asks.
Well, we learned about his relationship with Rosie.
Had your mother suspected anything? Sunny asks.
Baker can't believe he's being put on the spot like this. But it's refreshing, in a way, to answer questions that everyone must be asking in his or her head.
She had no idea, Baker says. It came as a complete shock, jaw-dropping. For days, I think we all believed there'd been a mistake, that it was a different Russell Steele. But then, yeah, we accepted it was my dad. He owned a giant hilltop villa that we knew nothing about. He had a whole life. A second life.
You'll forgive me for saying so, Phil says, but it seems unusual that you stayed on the island where your father had a second family.
Dad,
Ayers says. It wasn't our plan to stay, Baker says. Each of us ended up back here for his or her own reasons. I can only speak for myself. I was living in Houston. My marriage fell apart. My almost ex-wife took a job at the Cleveland Clinic.
Impressive, Sunny says.
And I met Ayers. I decided I wanted to try to make our relationship work.
He can see the warning in Ayers' eyes, but he ignores it.
I came down here without knowing about the baby. But I'm excited. No, thrilled about the news. And I plan to be a hands-on father, just like I am with Floyd.
Well, Sunny says, I'm overcome. What a beautiful thing to say.
We ended up losing my father's villa a few weeks ago,
Baker says. He clears his throat.
There was tax trouble, legal trouble. And that was a hurdle for all of us, my mother, brother, and me, because we had all planned on living there. It was spacious.
Yeah, Ayers says.
It's almost better that we aren't at the villa anymore.
Baker realizes these words are true only as he's saying them. It was tainted.
Don't get me wrong, it was luxurious. The wow factor was high, but I think that masked the truth, which was that we didn't belong there. I've rented the place right across the street from here, and although it's a tight fit right now, I'm confident my mom and brother will find their own spaces in time.
Across the street from here, Sunny says. How convenient.
Phil leads Baker to the door.
You've made a very fine first impression, Baker Steele.
Baker raises his eyebrows at Ayers. Your parents like me. Ayers whistles and Winnie lifts her head, jumps off the bed, and joins Ayers on the couch.
We must arrange a dinner with your mom and brother, Sunny says. A family affair. But we can't do it tonight because we're taking Freddie and Michael out.
To the beach bar at Keneal, Phil says. Supposedly they have decent sushi.
We spent 9 months traveling through Japan in the early aughts, Sunny says. And do you want to know where we found the best sushi?
Gate 35 at Narita Airport, Phil says. The tuna special. I dream about it.
Baker is still trying to figure out who Freddie and Michael are. Friends of theirs? A gay couple? Then he remembers that Ayers is Freddie. But who's Michael?
Who's Michael?
He asks.
Mick, Phil says. We're taking out Ayers and Mick.
Mick makes him sound like an Irish hoodlum or a horny rock star, Sonny says. I prefer to call him by his given name.
Ayers rubs Winnie's head. Is she even listening to this conversation?
You're taking out Ayers and Mick? Baker says.
It's been so long since we've seen him, Sunny says.
Somehow, Baker makes it through the door, saying graciously,
Enjoy the sushi. Hope it's decent. Come see me in the morning. We'll look at one bedrooms and two bedrooms. Nice to meet you. All righty, will do. Yep, yep, yep. Bye-bye.
And then, mercifully, Phil closes the door. Taking out Ayers and Mick? Baker heads across the street, limping like he has an old sports injury. Mick is the old sports injury, the one Baker can't seem to recover from, until he's at his front door and can safely disappear into what should now be known as the heartbroken hibiscus. Huck. He calls Agent Vasco to tell her about the diaries.
Have you read them?
She asks.
Yes,
he says.
Are they going to give me what I need?
They better, Huck thinks, because I sacrificed my relationship with Irene for them. Only you would know,
Huck says. He's on his deck smoking. He's been going through half a pack a day since Irene moved out.
Should I mail them to you, or are you on the island?
We're on the island today, Vasco says. Can I swing by around 11?
I have a charter, Huck says. I'll leave them on the mail table just inside my front door. You remember where I live? Up Jacob's Ladder?
You don't lock up?
I have nothing to steal, Huck says.
Fine, we'll be by, Vasco says.
She pauses.
Thank you for calling me.
I want to cooperate, Huck says. Can you tell me what's up with Douglas and Paulette Vickers?
In the vault? Vasco says.
Of course.
We offered them a deal if they gave us something tangible on Croft, but they refused. Insisted he was no part of it, that it was only Steele and Thompson.
Wow, Huck says.
So the Vickerses will serve time for fraud and money laundering. They allowed Ascension to buy and sell land from one fictional entity to another using their real estate concern. Welcome to Paradise Real Estate was as dirty as they come.
They'll both serve time, Huck says. What about their son?
Staying with Douglas's sister on St. Croix. Vasco sighs. Those diaries are my last shot. Croft is a slippery bastard. I'd love to nail him. Vasco is tough. Huck likes that about her. Huck is distracted on his charter. He has three lawyers from Philadelphia on board who are going out on the boat only so they can escape their wives, smoke the Cuban cigars they scored in the BVIs, and enjoy a day on the water. They don't care if they catch any fish. All good. Less concentration required from Huck. He hates to phone it in, but he can't get his mind off the question of whether or not to call Irene when they get back to the dock. Would she want to know about Paulette and Douglas Vickers? He normally would say yes, but now all bets are off. She has been radio silent since she left. He thought she'd come to her senses and that one of these mornings, he would find her waiting by the Mississippi with two sausage biscuits and two cups of strong black coffee. But no such luck. He won't call her, he thinks. She made it clear she didn't want to talk about those diaries ever again. He misses her at work. He misses her at home. He tries to maintain for Maya's sake. He continues to grill mahi or he stops at Candy's for barbecue, but more often than not, he feeds Maya and drinks his own dinner, smokes his dessert. He doesn't make any move to hire a new mate because he can't handle the idea of breaking someone in, and, too, he thinks Irene will return if he waits her out. Without a mate, he often can't pick Maya up from school, so he leans on Julie Judge more than he should. He feels like he's losing his grip on where Maya goes, how she spends her days. Well, she needs food on the table, and she likes to be able to order new clothes from Amazon. Her bath bomb business seems to have stalled. Something new has her attention. Boys, probably. One night over dinner, it's not even Candy's, it's leftover Candy's. That's how sorry a state Huck is in. He says,
maybe you could make some extra money babysitting for Floyd.
Floyd has plenty of babysitters now, Maya says. Irene is there. And Cash moved in too.
Cash moved in? Huck says. I thought he was living over in Peter Bay with what's her name?
Tilda, Maya says. They broke up. Tilda is dating some super rich guy who bought Livongo Key. Tilda's parents are building an eco resort there.
Yes, Huck has heard whisperings about this around town. A resort on Livongo will bring in some high-end clientele, which everyone is excited about. It means more potential fishing clients. Huck would be excited too if he could only summon the energy.
How do you know all this? Huck asks.
Airs. Maya says.
She finishes her coleslaw and eyes Huck as she sets down her fork.
If I tell you something, can you keep it a secret?
All he can think is that she's going to tell him something about Irene. She bought a boat. She signed on with rival fishing boat. What a catch. She's moving back to the States.
I can, yes, he says.
Ayers is pregnant, Maya says. With Baker's baby.
Huck would have said he was too old and jaded for anything to bowl him over, but Maya just proved him wrong. He thinks back to the last time he saw Ayers, when she gave him the diaries. She looked piqued, to say the least.
You're kidding.
Nope. She told me the other day.
And Baker is the father? Baker, not Mick?
Isn't that crazy?
Maya says. She lifts a rib off Huck's plate that he didn't have any appetite for.
Their baby will be my niece or nephew. And if Ayers and Baker get married?
Maya's eyes light up. Ares will be my sister-in-law. We'll all be related.
Huck wonders if Irene knows. She must. What the hell does she think about that? Well, there is one silver lining. Irene Steele isn't going anywhere with a new grandbaby on the way. The next morning, Huck sees Irene pull into the Gift Hill School parking lot to drop off Floyd. Even the sight of her, chestnut braid, white scoop-neck t-shirt, the blocky sunglasses that look like what an elderly person with cataracts wears, addles Huck.
Irene,
he calls out through his open window. He wants to talk to her about Ayers and Baker, a baby coming, her new grandchild. Forget the FBI and Russ and the diaries. The pregnancy is good news, beautiful news. He catches Irene by surprise. She glances over, sees it's him, and, without missing a beat, throws Baker's Jeep in reverse, backs out of the lot, and goes screaming down Gift Hill, which is in the opposite direction of her house. She must really want to get away from him. After dinner that evening, Huck smokes two cigarettes in rapid succession on the deck. He passes through the kitchen, then hits reverse, pulls the Flor de Caña off the shelf, does a shot, then a second shot. He checks on Maya. She's at her desk studying, not on her phone, a small miracle.
I'm going to read for a bit, Nut, he says. Good night.
He goes into his bedroom and sits at his desk, which is where he keeps his laptop and a paper calendar listing all his charters, as well as files for bills and boat maintenance. He pulls a piece of paper from the tray of his printer, finds a pen that works, and thinks,
here goes nothing.
He writes a letter to Irene. He doesn't worry about his spelling or word choice. He doesn't start over when he wants to change his phrasing, just crosses things out. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be true. When he's finished, he reads it through, folds it in thirds, sticks it in an envelope. He's probably the only fool on earth who's still handwriting letters, but what he had to say shouldn't be texted and she won't talk to him. A letter is outdated, but it will also be difficult to resist reading. He hopes. He just has to figure out how to get it to her. A few days later, Maya stays overnight with Ayers. It's the first time Huck has been alone since Irene left. He could easily go out and spend a few hours tinkering on the boat, then grab a burger from the tap and still on the way home. Or he could buy some good beer, grill some tuna, lie down in his hammock, and finally crack open the Patterson book. But when he pulls up to the National Park Service dock and lets out his charter guests, a perfectly nice couple from he can't remember where and their three boys, who were all in boarding school. They obviously didn't see one another very often because they were so happy to be together. He hears steel drum music coming from Mongoose Junction, blending with strains of Kenny Chesney over at Joe's Rum Hut. Save it for a rainy day. And he decides he doesn't want to be alone. He calls Rupert.
You out?
Yes, sir.
Skinny?
Aqua. Good, Huck thinks. He's been craving the Aqua Bistro's onion rings for a while now.
I'll be there in an hour, he says.
I'll be waiting, Rupert says.
But I gotta meet Sadie at Skinny at 9 and Dora at Miss Lucy's at 10:30.
Typical Rupert. He has a woman at every watering hole. No doubt Josephine will be singing tonight at the Aqua Bistro. Huck will hurry and shower. He loves Josephine's voice. 45 minutes later, Huck is seated at the round open-air bar of Aqua Bistro next to Rupert. Josephine is playing the guitar, lulling everyone into a sense of well-being with her sultry rendition of Come Away With Me. Rupert orders tequila shots with beer backs.
Don't forget, I have to drive home, Huck says.
Ha! That's no excuse on this island. Stay left, go slow, tell the donkeys to get out of your way. You and I both know you could do it blindfolded.
They click shot glasses and throw the tequila back. Huck feels okay. He slaps down $5 and asks for the roll. The bartender hands him a leather cup filled with dice. He shakes it and lets them spill. Nothing. Rupert laughs.
Might as well have taken out your lighter and set your money on fire.
It's something to do. Only locals can roll. Irene can't roll. The invisible man couldn't roll. Huck's luck has been so damn awful this week that it'll surely take a turn soon. Why not now? He throws the dice. 3, 3s, 5, 6.
The pot is over $1,000, the bartender says. Nobody's won since before Christmas.
Josephine sings, "Do you know the way to San Jose?" Only she changes San Jose to Coral Bay.
I love that woman, Rupert says.
You love a lot of women, Huck says.
Part of him wishes he were built this way, but he isn't. He loves Irene.
I love you, Irene,
he thinks, and he throws the dice one last time. 2 4s, 2 1s, and a 6. The bartender sweeps up his money. Rupert says nothing, but Huck can sense him wanting to blurt out, "I told you so."
Heard you and the invisible man's wife are shacking up, Rupert says.
You're behind on your gossip. She moved out.
Any fool off the street could have told you that wasn't going to work, Rupert says. There's too much tangled up between you.
Huck wants to tell Rupert he knows nothing about it, but he doesn't like to bicker with Rupert, and also the phrase tangled up feels like a bullseye. Huck and Irene have always communicated on the level, but beneath all that was a mess both of them had willfully ignored, because neither of them had created it. Those diaries must have been salt in a wide open wound. Huck should never, ever have showed them to her. It must have seemed like he wanted to hurt her when the truth was he assumed she was so strong and resilient that Rosie's words wouldn't matter.
Why would they matter when she has me? Huck had thought.
He was there for her day in, day out, waiting, adoring, offering whatever support and encouragement she needed. Wasn't that enough? Why did the events of 13 years or 6 years or 2 years earlier matter? Huck spins his finger at the bartender. Another round. More shots, more beers. He found a way to get Irene the letter, ingeniously, or so he thought. He hasn't heard from her.
Yet. You're right, Huck says to Rupert. It was never going to work.
Josephine takes a break and comes to sit between them. Onion rings arrive, compliments of the kitchen. Huck admires them, fat, golden, glistening with oil, stacked on a dowel like so many rings in a game of quoits. Did he eat any?
He couldn't say. He might have waited for them to cool and then forgotten about them. Another beer.
Rupert says, Jojo, you have any lady friends you could introduce to Huck here?
I hear Huck's taken,
Josephine says. But Huck is saved from explaining that he's not because it's time for her second set.
Let's get out of here, Rupert says. I'm late for Sadie.
Huck follows Rupert around the road in Coral Bay over to Skinny Legs. The place is crowded, but there are 2 bar stools empty in the corner. How is this possible? Rupert must have called in on the way. They take the seats. Huck orders a margarita with salt. Rupert says,
Who are you, Jimmy Buffett?
He asks for Cruzan Gold over ice. Heidi is bartending. She's in the weeds, but she takes one glance at Huck and Rupert and says,
How about a couple of burgers, fellas?
Burgers, yes, sure.
There's a band playing songs that Huck doesn't recognize, and a bunch of kids in their 20s dancing. Tourists, spring breakers. Huck and Rupert are geezers in this crowd, but it doesn't matter. They're having fun. Heidi is taking good care of them. Huck feels a hand on his back, and he turns to see Sadie. She pulls Rupert up out of his chair, and he claps a hand on Huck's shoulder, which is his way of saying he won't be back. Please cover the check. Rupert will get him next time.
Fine, fine, Huck thinks.
Good for Rupert. Sadie is Huck's favorite of the women anyway. He should leave. But it's been so long since he's been out like this, and it's working like a tonic against the ache in his heart. He orders a beer in an attempt to sober up. He sees a familiar-looking blonde across the bar. She's one of the mothers from the Gift Hill School. He figures out that much, though he couldn't in a million years come up with her name. She's waving at him like crazy, and he raises his beer in a way he hopes says, "Yes, I see you. Please don't come over here." The band plays one last song, and when it's finished, the bar empties out somewhat. Finally, Huck can hear himself think. Heidi comes over and says, "Woman over there wants to buy you another drink. Beer?" "Please," Huck says.
"Which woman?"
He assumes it's the Gift Hill mother whose name he can't remember or never knew in the first place.
"Behind you," Heidi says.
Huck turns to see a redhead in a pale green dress sipping what looks like a painkiller over at the side bar. She's by herself, gazing out at the people drinking on the back deck. Is that who Heidi means? Well, yeah. She's the only woman behind him. The beer arrives. Huck takes a swallow, then checks behind him again. The woman is gone.
"Huh," he thinks. "Strange."
A second later, someone takes Rupert's stool. It's the redhead in the green dress.
"Good evening, Captain," she says.
Huck has had one, or a few, too many, perhaps. He has to back up a few inches to get a look at this woman. The mother on the boat today had red hair, but no. This is... The woman smiles.
"Holy shit," he thinks. "Agent Vasco?"
"Colette, please."
Colette. Tonight, she looks like a Colette. Her hair is sleek and shiny. The green dress has buttons down the front. The top button has been undone to reveal a bit of her modest cleavage. She's wearing lipstick.
"Thank you for the beer," he says.
"I'm happy I bumped into you."
He wonders for a second if she followed him here. She's an FBI agent. Is any contact accidental?
"Are we breaking the law?"
he asks.
"I'm off duty," she says, "and you're not under investigation."
She orders another painkiller from Heidi.
"I will break protocol to tell you one thing, though. Those diaries didn't give us enough to lock up Croft."
Huck spins his beer by the neck. All that for nothing?
"What about the stuff Russ told Rosie about the dummy driveways? About the illegal business dealings?"
"Hearsay."
"What about the end, where Croft shows up at La Tapa to threaten Rosie?"
"It isn't enough," Colette says.
"The person who's implicated is Steele. And even Rosie. You turned over the cash you found in the dresser drawer, but I had to persuade my superiors not to go after the money in Rosie's accounts. I made the argument that the amounts were consistent with what she might have saved from her job." Colette takes a healthy pull of her drink. "But we could easily have called those tainted assets." She did him a favor, and he's not ungrateful. He has that money to send Maya to college.
"Thank you," Huck says.
She dips her head and gazes up at him.
"I don't want you to think of me as the bad guy."
"You're just doing your job," Huck says. "I get it."
"I do have one last hope," Colette says. "Someone left a message at the field office saying she wants to talk to me about Croft. It was all very mysterious. She didn't leave a name, only a number. She might be a crackpot, or she thinks there's money in it for her. The only thing is, she asked for me specifically. So she might be for real."
"You'll follow up?" Huck asks.
"I'll follow up,"
Colette says. That's enough talk about work. Huck has another beer and buys Colette Vasco another painkiller. And then he can't wait another second. He has to have a cigarette. He says,
I'm going out to smoke. I'll be right back.
We share a vice, Colette says. I'll come with you. Huck tells Heidi they're coming right back, and the two of them go stand in the grass past the back patio. There are a few crooked palm trees, then the lip of Coral Bay. Huck lights Colette's cigarette. It feels a little weird. The last woman he smoked with was his first wife, Kimberly. She points to his left hand. What happened to your finger?
Barracuda, he says.
I love a man with scars, Colette says. Huck lets that comment slide, though it's starting to feel like she's flirting with him, maybe more than flirting, which he can't deny is good for his battered ego. How old is she? Maybe closer to 40 than he'd thought.
How did you end up in the Caribbean?
He asks. She tells him she's originally from New Jersey, around Manasquan, Brielle, Belmar. Springsteen territory, she adds, because he's never heard of any of those places. Colette's father was a policeman. She went to Rutgers. The FBI recruited her. She spent years working the ports, fell in love with her boss, got married, and when he was transferred to the field office in Puerto Rico, she went with him. She got promoted. They split. It's unclear to Huck if these two things are related. He went back to New Jersey. She stayed in Puerto Rico. The FBI acknowledged the need for a bigger white-collar crime investigative team in the territories. They're dangerously close to their original topic.
Time for me to call it a night, Huck says.
They wander back inside and Huck flags Heidi for the check.
I have a charter bright and early.
I should go too, Colette says. They end up walking out to the parking lot together. It's dark and unpaved, so Huck does the gentlemanly thing and offers Colette his arm.
You didn't drive the Suburban out here, did you?
I'm staying out here, she says. Company digs. I can't disclose the exact location, but it's close enough to walk. Huck is relieved. He's spared having to offer her a ride home.
Well, this is me,
he says, nodding at his truck. He lifts his arm in an attempt to reclaim it from her, and Colette grabs his hand, then winds her arms around his midsection and hip locks him.
Whoa.
Huck isn't sure what to do, but he has to make a decision right now. Colette Vasco is pretty, and there can be no mistaking her body language. She's ready to go, all the way.
Kiss her, Huck thinks. Take her home. What's stopping you? She's divorced, you're single, you're both lonely, and admit it, there's been something between you from the beginning.
He places his hands on Colette's shoulders, then cups her face and bends down. He kisses her once, gently, and is overcome by a strong wave of the worst emotion that exists in the world. Guilt. He pulls away. She presses farther into him. Huck.
Agent Vasco, he says.
He reaches behind his back and unclasps her hands, holds them in both of his.
You're a very attractive woman. But I'm involved with someone else.
He stops. Is he doing the right thing? Is he?
And although it is quite tempting to take you home and let things unfold as they may, that wouldn't be fair to her. Nor would it be fair to you. So I'm going to say goodnight. Please get home safely.
Colette Vasco stares at him with half a smile. Incredulous? Embarrassed? Drunk? And then disappears into the dark. Huck climbs into his truck, lights another cigarette, and blows the smoke out the window.
I hope you're happy, Irene Steele, he thinks. You've ruined me.
He starts the engine, thinking,
go slow, stay left. Donkeys, get out of my way.
Heirs. During the first week of their stay on St. John, Heirs' parents cover a lot of ground. On the very first day, they meet Baker and then take Mick and Heirs out to dinner. On their second day, they buy a two-bedroom timeshare at the Westin from Baker, and Heirs experiences predictable mixed feelings. On the one hand, she's comforted by this. On the other hand, she feels suffocated. In the following days, Phil and Sonny hike the Reef Bay Trail, charter the Singing Dog with Captains Stephen and Kelly to the BVIs. No Treasure Island for them, they want to sail. Experience happy hour at both Woody's and High Tide, snorkel with turtles at Salt Pond, dance to Miss Fairchild at the Beach Bar, buy matching hook bracelets at Bamboo, and kayak to Lime Out for tacos. And yet somehow they're still underfoot. They wake Heirs up with chai lattes from Provisions. They swing by with containers of sesame noodles and spinach artichoke dip from the North Shore Deli. They appear at La Tapa while Heirs is working and introduce themselves to the guests at Heirs' tables until she has to ask them to either sit at the bar or leave. They choose the bar and end up getting into a deep conversation with Skip about his trust issues with women. How is she ever going to survive them? When will they leave for Barbuda, Beckwe? The dinner with Mick was illuminating. Heirs wonders if, in her parents' minds, Mick is still her boyfriend. Maybe they haven't yet fully absorbed the news of the breakup or the idea that Heirs is pregnant by someone else. At dinner at the Longboard, which unfortunately evoked the evening of their engagement, Mick was his most charming self, sucking up to Phil and Sonny in every possible way, asking about their travels, begging to see their pictures, giving Sonny too much encouragement about her prospective blog. Heirs bit her tongue and thought, fake it to make it. All the while hoping the staff at the Longboard weren't getting out their phones in the back to broadcast the news that Mick and Heirs were together again. What Heirs realized while being smushed up in a booth next to Mick was that her feelings for him had changed. She'd broken the engagement because she was smart. Mick would never stop cheating. But it hadn't changed the fact that she loved him. Being pregnant with Baker's baby hadn't canceled out her feelings for Mick either. It was amazing the things that love could endure. Nothing demonstrated this more than her ups and downs with Mick had. But at dinner with her parents, Heirs had been pleasantly surprised to find that she felt nothing for Mick other than a mixture of mild annoyance and nostalgic fondness. After Phil and Sonny headed back to Keneal, Mick walked Heirs to her truck and tried to kiss her. She ducked out of the way. She felt no attraction to him. Finally, she thought. The vine Mick had wrapped around her heart was withering. She had spent much of the previous 6 months hating Mick for what had happened with Bridget. But hate was not the opposite of love. Indifference was the opposite of love. And for the first time, Heirs felt like she could take Mick or leave him. Tonight, she would leave him. Good night, she said. Later, when Heirs was home in bed with Winnie snoring softly at her feet, she'd texted Baker. Survived dinner with Mick. Sorry about that. My parents wanted to see him. There was no response, which was unusual. Heirs wondered if maybe she'd blown it. At noon the next day, Baker still hadn't responded, and she nearly sent a second text asking if he wanted to grab lunch. But she decided this would be confusing. She was the one who had asked for space. He was giving it to her. When their visit enters its second week, Phil and Sonny decide it's time to introduce themselves to Irene Steele. Heirs tries to dissuade them. Irene is reserved. She may not appreciate being ambushed without warning, but Sunny waves Ayers' concerns away like incense smoke. They see Baker and Floyd get back from school, and the instant Irene arrives home with cash, they gather up Winnie, a bottle of champagne, and a charcuterie platter from Island Cork. "Come over after your shower, Fred," Sunny says, which bugs Ayers for several reasons. She doesn't want to shower, and she doesn't want to socialize. She says, "I'm tired, Mama. I'm going to lie down for a little while." Sunny immediately changes her tune. Yes, Ayers should sleep. The first trimester is so taxing on the body. Sunny starts talking about being in Western Australia on an ostrich farm that was owned by a woman who was also a potter. She made the most beautiful bowls. "Mama, please," Ayers says. She lies down on her bed and pulls the comforter over her head. The last thing she hears is Sunny saying to Phil, "Leave her be, honey." When Ayers awakens, it's dark outside and her parents are back, laughing, whispering, bumping into things, shushing each other. Ayers checks her phone, 10:30. They went across the street at 5. "Mom," she says. "Dad?" They erupt in giggles. Ayers feels like she's the parent right now. "Have you been across the street this whole time?" "Oh, Freddie," Sunny says. "It's going to be so great." "What is?"
"Irene took a while to warm up," Phil says. "But by the fourth bottle of wine?"
"Fourth?
Plus the champagne," Sunny says. "So technically, 5.
"Irene likes her Chardonnay," Phil says.
"What is going to be so great?" Ayers asks.
"Our family," Sunny says. "The family we're creating with the Steels. And that Cash, what a cutie."
"Your mother has a crush on him," Phil says. "She made that much obvious."
"He's single," Sunny says. "I'm surprised you didn't end up with him, Freddie. He's much more your type, outdoorsy."
"Cash and I are friends, Mom. We work together."
Ayers sits up in bed and pats the comforter. Winnie leaps up.
"So you all had a great time and you drank the night away?"
"Baker made fish tacos," Phil says. "That guy can really cook."
"Floyd let me read to him before bed," Sunny says. "I feel like a real grandma already."
"We discussed our grandparent names," Phil says. "Irene is Grammy, so Mom will be Mimi. I'm torn between Pop-Pop and Granddaddy."
He clears his throat. "It's a big responsibility, being this child's only grandfather."
"We heard the whole story about Russ," Sunny says. "Very interesting."
"If by interesting you mean tragic, then yeah," Ayers says.
"I think what's interesting is the way Irene has come to terms with the situation. She blames Russ, but she also blames herself for taking Russ for granted, for not paying attention to the marriage, for all kinds of things."
"Wow, you guys really got into it," Ayers says. "Did you talk about me?"
"When we first got there, we told them you were tired," Sunny says. "And then we talked about the baby."
"But other than that, your name didn't come up," Phil says.
Ayers is both relieved and bothered by this. Her parents and the Steels are out forging a new family together, but somehow the most important person, the person carrying the baby that will unite them, doesn't matter. Her parents gather their things to return to their room at Keneal. In 2 short days, they're off on their Caribbean adventure, thank goodness. And as soon as the front door closes, Ayers sends Baker a text.
"Thank you for entertaining my parents. I'm sure they overstayed their welcome."
Baker doesn't respond. Well, maybe he's asleep. But when Ayers gets up to check, she sees a light on in what she knows is Baker's bedroom. She has a strong impulse to tiptoe over and knock on his window. Maybe even encourage him to come over. Maybe even... She climbs back into bed. Space, she thinks.
Two nights later, Ayers is working at La Tapa. Her parents left that morning on the 10 o'clock ferry. They'll be gone for 6 to 8 weeks. Ayers is relieved, happy even. They'll be back, but she doesn't have to deal with them right now. Tilda approaches Ayers at the back service station. I assume you've heard? God alone knows what Tilda is going to drop on her. Heard you left cash for some wealthy guy who doesn't eat? Yes, Ayers has heard about that in gory detail from Cash. Ayers won't lie. It has colored her opinion of Tilda. Tilda is entitled to see whomever she pleases, but going away with a rich boy and leaving Cash in the dust seems crueler than your average breakup. Heard what? Ayers asks. Mick quit the beach bar, Tilda says. He's leaving Island. That must be a mistake, Ayers says. He told me at dinner last week that he signed a 1-year lease at his new place, Pure Joy. He's trying to find someone to take over his lease. Really? Ayers says. Where's he going? You should probably ask him that, Tilda says. Tilda is back to being very annoying, even more annoying than when she had a crush on Skip. On her way home, Ayers calls Mick. Word on the street is that you quit the beach bar? You're leaving Island?
Yes, Mick says. And yes.
Wow, Ayers says, though she still doesn't believe him. He's been at the beach bar a Caribbean eternity, 11 years.
I can't live on this island and not be with you, he says.
Ayers knew it. This is all a ploy to get her back. He planned this with Tilda. They're in cahoots. Well, I'm never coming back to you. I'm not in love with you anymore. So I guess you'd better go.
Yeah, he clears his throat. Any chance you want to take over the lease on Pure Joy?
Damn straight I do, she says. He may be bluffing, but she's dead serious. Pure Joy is a one-bedroom with incredible views across Great Cruz Bay over to St. Thomas, views that are best enjoyed sitting at the cute bar counter on the front porch. Ayers is sure her parents will help her with the rent.
I thought you might move in with Banker and his kid. Play house, happy family, and all that.
No plans to, Ayers says. I definitely want your place.
Cool, Mick says. I want to leave as soon as I can. I've been offered a position as food and beverage director at Tucker's Point in Bermuda.
Ayers hoots. Will you wear knee socks?
I think I might have to, Mick says. The resort is 5-star, so the job has more responsibility. The only downside is the shorts and knee socks look. My legs are so stubby.
So, you're doing this?
Yes, he says.
Things move fast, so fast. The next day, Ayers meets Mick at the real estate office to sign paperwork for the lease. Mick is leaving this weekend. Ayers can move in as soon as he's out.
What are you doing with your place? Mick asks.
Cash is taking it, Ayers says. This whole thing is almost too easy. Cash can move off his brother's couch right into Ayers' studio apartment across the street. He and Winnie will be reunited. Ayers isn't sure how Baker feels about her leaving Fish Bay, but it's not like she's leaving for St. Thomas or even Coral Bay. She'll be on Great Cruz Bay Road, halfway between the Happy Hibiscus and the Westin Timeshare office. And it's only for a year. It will be a big, scary year, but Ayers isn't going to let that stop her. She loved the cottage when Mick showed it to her. Now, it's hers. On Saturday, when Mick is scheduled to leave, Ayers drives down to the car barge to say goodbye. She can't quite figure out why she wants to do this. She supposes that part of it is to witness the milestone, the moment her boyfriend of 9 years moves on. Part of it is to make sure he actually goes, and part of it is to kiss Gordon one last time. The car barge is, as always, a whirl of activity with a snaking line of cars and jeeps and pickups and huge Mack trucks waiting to board, and a notoriously unflappable West Indian woman named Sheila overseeing who goes where. More than once, Ayers has witnessed Sheila letting her friends and sweethearts jump the line, which isn't fair, but nobody ever questions Sheila. Sheila is a cousin of Rosie's on her father's side, and because of this, Sheila likes Ayers.
"You getting on, doll?" she asks.
"Saying goodbye to someone," Ayers says.
"And good riddance?" Sheila asks.
"Kind of, yeah," Ayers says, and Sheila chuckles. Ayers almost doesn't recognize Mick's blue Jeep because it has the top on. Has she ever seen his Jeep with the top on? She doesn't think so. She and Mick got caught in rain showers in that thing probably 100 times. The seats held a damp smell, and Mick eventually pulled up the rugs so that water emptied through the holes in the floorboards. Ayers parks her truck over by Sheila's guardhouse. As she strides toward Mick's Jeep, she hears Gordon barking. Automatically, she tears up. She promised herself she wouldn't become emotional, but that dog was like her first child, and she's going to miss him. They're loading the boat. She has to hurry. She runs up behind the Jeep and goes to the driver's side, where Gordon is hanging his head out the window.
"Who's a good boy?" she says.
"Hey," Mick says. "What are you doing here?"
"Came to say goodbye to my pup."
Ayers is at the window, her hands cradling Gordon's bucket head. When she realizes there's someone in the passenger seat of the Jeep, it's Bridget.
"Hey, Ayers," Bridget says. "Thanks for seeing us off. Good luck with your baby."
She says the word like it's something imaginary, and she holds up 2 fingers in a peace sign. She looks at Mick.
"Bridget's going with you to Bermuda?"
He nods. "Yeah."
Ayers kisses Gordon between the eyes, then leans in past Mick.
"Goodbye, Bridget," she says.
She returns the peace sign, ironically, but Bridget will never know this. Sheila whistles, windmilling her arm. It's time for Mick to go. Ayers watches the blue Jeep drive up the ramp of the barge.
"And good riddance," Ayers says.
The very next day, Ayers wakes up feeling like a new woman. She got a long, luxurious night's sleep, and for the first time in weeks, she feels hungry. She makes not only buttered rye toast, but also cheesy scrambled eggs. She takes her prenatal vitamin, drinks a glass of juice, eats a banana. She figures she needs 2 days to pack her things and 1 day to move them. Then she'll be back in action. She calls Whitney at the Treasure Island office.
"I can work again, starting on Wednesday," she says.
It's as though Ayers has crossed an invisible boundary. Her body was her enemy, but now it's a friend. She has energy. She has vitality. The tiny life inside her might as well be a supercharged battery. Ayers moves into pure joy. While Ayers' studio was funky and bohemian, but gloomy with a view only of the happy hibiscus, pure joy is bright and airy, filled with sunlight. She has actual rooms, a living/dining/kitchen area, a brand new bath with gleaming white subway tile, a bedroom with a king-size bed, and a bona fide walk-in closet. The cottage has a gas grill and an enclosed outdoor shower, and Ayers will spend every spare minute on one of the stools at the bar counter, gazing at the dreamscape across her new front yard, the striated blue and green shades of the Caribbean. Ayers sets her mugs and plates and wine glasses on the fresh white shelves in the kitchen. She puts new sheets on the bed. She hangs her photographs. She sets her house plans in the sun. During her last check of her old studio, she discovers the hidden pack of cigarettes on top of the refrigerator and throws them away. Her first night in the new place, she gets barbecue from Candy's, ribs and chicken and pasta salad and coleslaw and plantains. And she sits at the bar counter on her front porch to watch the sun sink into the Caribbean. Hashtag sunset, she thinks. Mick is gone, she's pregnant, and she has a new place to live. It all feels like a fresh start. She picks up her phone and nearly sends a text to Baker saying, "Want to see my new place?" But it's only her first night. There's plenty of time. A leave of absence from Treasure Island was exactly what she needed, because she comes back rejuvenated. Virgin Gorda baths, snorkeling at the Indians, White Bay on Yost Van Dyke, where Leon, the bartender at the Soggy Dollar, makes her a virgin painkiller.
"Congratulations, love," Leon says. "When will I meet this child's daddy?"
"Soon," Ayers says. She wonders if she should invite Baker and Floyd out on the boat so they can experience the BVIs and see her in action. Yes, they would like it. When they get back to Cruise Bay, Ayers checks the schedule and sees there are plenty of spots on Saturday's charter. She texts Baker. "BVI trip Saturday. You and Floyd? My treat?" The response comes,
"Nice offer, thank you. Floyd doesn't have a passport."
Ah, bummer, Ayers thinks. He's only 4, but yeah, he still needs a passport. How about just you then? Leave Floyd with your mom?
"I shouldn't," he says. "Weekends are my time with Floyd. Sorry about that."
"He's a good dad," she thinks. "He's a really good dad." A few nights later, Ayers leaves La Tapa after service, and she's so tired that she drives to Fish Bay without thinking. It's only when she pulls into her former driveway and sees Cash's new used truck that she realizes she's on autopilot. Ugh. She might need Tilda to close from now on so she can get out of the restaurant earlier. Tilda won't like this. She has been the one slipping out early, rushing her tables, neglecting to offer dessert, coffee, or aperitifs, snapping at Skip for change, all because her new beau, Dunk, likes to linger across the street outside the Tap and Still, vaping and waiting for Tilda to emerge. Ayers has studied him. He's always in jeans and a t-shirt and a baseball cap and sambas, looking more like a guy with an online poker habit than a multimillionaire with an estate out in the East End. But Ayers supposes that's part of the appeal. Dunk looks shady, which Tilda has mistaken for mysterious. She finds his fasting intriguing rather than ridiculous. She's young. She'll learn. As Ayers is backing out of her former driveway, she sees, in her rearview mirror, 2 people coming out of the Happy Hibiscus. It's Baker and a woman. Tall, blonde. Wait a minute. Ayers pulls back into her former driveway, turns off her lights, cuts her engine. She squints into the mirror. Do they see her? No. Baker and the woman are standing by an ivory Land Cruiser that Ayers recognizes as belonging to Swan Seeley. Baker is walking Swan Seeley out to her car at 10:30 at night. Are they seeing each other? Is this why he hasn't responded to her texts? No, Ayers thinks. No. She can't let this happen. And yet this is all her fault. She told Baker she needed space. She told Baker she wanted to be friends. Friends! After he moved his entire life down here. After he handled the news of her pregnancy like a hero. Has he complained? No. Has he been even a little bit of a jerk like literally any other guy in America would have been? No. He stopped by with a smoothie and chips. She had seen him another time, with Floyd in tow, bearing coffee and a bakery bag, and she'd burrowed into her bed, not even answering the door. She'd skipped the impromptu visit by her parents. She had been so certain that Baker would be there when she was ready that she had never considered another woman might step in, a woman such as Swan Seeley, a Gift Hill mother who was going through a divorce and who told Ayers the afternoon that Mick proposed that she thought Baker was hot. And now here they are, Baker and Swan, standing by the driver's side of Swan's car, about to have a moment. They're talking, but not touching. Swan tosses her hair, leans her head back, raises her face to his. She lays her palm on Baker's strong chest, and Ayers feels a pang of longing. The first time she saw Baker was at Chester's getaway, when he crashed Rosie's funeral reception. He had seemed such a stunning, fresh presence in that sea of all too familiar faces, some of which were also all too unpleasant. Mick had had the gall to bring Bridget. At first, Ayers thought Baker was a tourist. Learning he was the Invisible Man's son had been shocking, but on later reflection, she'd known there was something about him. She sensed that meeting him wasn't random luck. Rosie, in a way, had sent him to her. Then he went back to Houston. Then he returned. They'd slept together. It had felt right. They clicked. There was light, heat, chemistry. Then he left again. For only a few days. But a few days was a few days too many. Mick proposed. Then Baker came back. He's here now. He has a job, a jeep, a villa. Floyd is in school. Baker is a tourist no longer. Swan takes hold of Baker's arms and stands on her tiptoes. No, Ayers thinks. She gets out of the truck, slams the door. Both Baker and Swan turn toward the noise. Swan's heels hit the ground. Hey, Ayers calls out. She crosses the street and strides up the driveway to the two of them. They're standing farther apart now. Swan looks miffed. Ayers? Baker says, Ayers, hey. He takes a step away from Swan.
Sorry, I didn't text or anything, Ayers says to Baker. But I just got out of work and I was wondering if you wanted to come see my new place?
Swan emits an audible breath and Ayers thinks, I know. This is brazen. You will rewind and replay this moment for your school mom friends dozens of times until they're all sick of hearing it. And maybe none of you will ever speak to me again. Maybe you'll boycott La Tapa and post anonymous nasty comments on the Treasure Island TripAdvisor page, but I don't care. Baker is the father of my baby. And although I've treated him carelessly, I'm not giving him up without a fight. Then she thinks, the good news is Skip is still available.
Yeah, Baker says. My mom can watch Floyd, and Swan was just leaving.
He takes Ayers' hand and squeezes it.
I'd love to come with you.
Irene. Baker sees Maya at school while he's picking up Floyd and invites her over for dinner.
I hope that's okay, he says when he tells Irene. I'll go get her and drive her home.
Of course, Irene says. She still isn't ready for a detente with Huck. Nope, not at all. Rosie's relationship with Russ happened while Rosie was living under Huck's roof. He said he'd never met Russ. Irene believes this. But could he not guess the man Rosie was involved with was married? Obviously, the Invisible Man was married. That was why he was invisible. Huck should have asked more questions. He should have followed Rosie to the villa. He should have put an end to it. Are these unreasonable expectations? Maybe. But the bald fact remains. Huck stood by and did nothing. For years. He's the only one left for Irene to blame. She can't summon the same ire or resentment toward Maya. Maya is a child. Russ's daughter, the boy's sister. Maya is always welcome, Irene says, and she sees relief cross Baker's face. Maya arrives bearing two large square packages, one light, which she carries, and one heavy, which Baker carries.
These came for you, Maya explains, to Gramps' postbox.
While Maya and Floyd take a pre-dinner swim in the pool, Irene slices the packages open. One of them holds her Christmas ornaments, still carefully wrapped up in tissue. Irene sighs, recalling her industriousness on New Year's Day before her dinner with Lydia at the Pullman Diner, before the phone call when she learned Russ was dead. On New Year's Day, she had been a different person. Irritated and hurt that her husband was traveling for work over the holiday, but determined to make the best of it and be productive. She'd wanted to wake up on January 2nd and have all traces of Christmas gone. Back then, nothing had annoyed Irene more than lazy neighbors who left their outside lights up until Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, their wreaths up until Valentine's Day. She had carefully removed and wrapped all the ornaments because she was a methodical person who believed God was in the details. She would be grateful for the effort the following Christmas when she opened the box and everything was just so. She'd never imagined she'd be opening the box that spring in the Virgin Islands. The most precious ornaments aren't her collection of intricate and clever Christopher Radcos or the vintage ornaments she picked up at estate sales across the country, but rather the ornaments the boys made in elementary school. A cardboard disc covered in green foil decorated with beads and dried macaroni, cash written in glitter on one side. A puffy painted Santa face with cotton glued on for a beard. Irene is happy to have these back, even though they belonged to that other lifetime. The other box holds photo albums and the framed family photographs that Irene had had on display around the house on Church Street. The photo that greets Irene is the last picture taken of her and Russ together. They're side by side on the front porch swing at her aunt's house in Door County, Wisconsin. They're smiling at Cash, who took the picture. Russ's arm runs along the back of the swing behind Irene, and Irene's hand rests on Russ's thigh, lightly but proprietarily. Why wouldn't it? He was her husband of 35 years. She would characterize Russ's expression as content. Irene then flashes back to the photograph she found of him and Rosie lying in the hammock. He had looked ecstatic, as though he had no idea how he'd gotten so lucky. A girlfriend whose beauty was as rarefied as the Mona Lisa's. Irene had wanted to smash the photograph of Russ and Rosie, but she feels an even greater violence toward this picture of her and Russ. The audacity of him to smile at the camera as though nothing is amiss, as though he doesn't have a mistress and a child waiting for him down in the Caribbean. Irene steadies her breathing and checks out the window. Baker is drinking a beer, his legs dangling in the water. Maya is carrying Floyd around the pool on her shoulders. He's shrieking with joy. He adores her. Irene digs a little deeper in the box and finds the navy leather photo album and the red vinyl photo album. These hold pictures of the boys growing up. She can see the snapshots without looking at them. Baker on